Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, it's an investment outlook special, and we've invited you to let us know what's on your mind and to submit questions to the Outlook's author, Tom Stevenson. There's certainly no shortage of topics giving investors something to worry about right now, whether it's inflation, China, gold or cryptocurrencies. We've got the answers for you. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Every quarter, the Investment Outlook from Fidelity attempts to lay out where markets are now and where they may be headed in the months ahead. And, as is now traditional when a new outlook is published, we've invited you to submit your questions to the team here and in particular to the Outlook's author, Tom Stevenson. And I'm pleased to say that Tom joins me now and we've given over the podcast this week to answering some of those questions. If you want to read the Investment Outlook for yourself or watch the webcast recorded by Tom and I that accompanies it, you'll find all of that at fidelity.co.uk/outlook. Tom, before we get stuck in, I need to say that while we're going to be answering listener questions here, what we're going to say is not financial advice or personalised in any way. If you do need that, please seek out professional advice. That said, Tom, let's get started. And the first question, I think, is indicative of many questions that we've had this time round. And it says this: given that the market will suffer a correction or a crash, what sectors are less likely to be affected and how long before recovery? So quite a pessimistic tone there, Tom.
Yes, I mean, I don't disagree with the fundamental premise. I mean, I do think that there will be a correction at some point. I wouldn't go so far as to say there'll be a crash, because I don't actually think that is, you know, likely or necessarily the case. But a correction is different. I mean, if you look back over the last 60 years or so, I saw some data on this, and it looked at the 3 years that followed the market bottoms after bear markets during that 60-year period. And in each of those three-year recovery periods, there was always at least one correction of at least 10% in the market, sometimes more than one. So, you know, we're now 18 months on from the bottom of the COVID bear market, and we haven't had a double-digit correction. Now, what we have had in the last month or so is a 5% retreat for the market as a whole. So it's not unreasonable to ask the question, you know, are we in the sort of early stages of a correction? And, you know, the short answer is yes, we may be. I don't know. No one else knows whether we are in a correction. But it's certainly true that the odds have shortened on a correction. If you think about, you know, the list of things to worry about, it has certainly got longer. We've talked about many of these things in the past here. Inflation, rising interest rates, valuations quite high, earnings beginning to level out after their strong recovery, supply chain disruptions, rising energy prices, rising wages. You know, there are lots of things to be concerned about. So, sorry, to get back to the question, which is, you know, which sectors are likely to be less affected and how long before the recovery? Well, I mean, I guess that the sectors which are likely to be least affected are the ones which have, which enjoy some kind of pricing power. I mean, I think what we're facing is an inflationary shock to the market. And so companies which are most affected by rising prices, by rising energy inputs, by rising wages, are likely to be affected. And of course, to some extent, that's every company. Every company is likely to be affected by inflation and by rising interest rates, but some more so than others. Clearly, companies which have a high energy input, for example, and we've seen the impact of rising gas prices in all sorts of unexpected places, you know, like the creation of CO2, of course, which we've talked about before. Yeah. How long before the recovery kicks in? That's a very interesting question, and I've been thinking a lot about this, because when you look at the data on recovery times, the reassurance is always, oh, well, if you hang around long enough, then the market will always recover. If you invest for 20 years, then there are no examples where the market has not gone up over the last 100 years, that kind of thing, which is sort of reassuring, but it's also not very reassuring, especially if you're an older investor. If you're in your 60s or 70s, then the prospect of holding your investments for another 20 years probably doesn't seem that reassuring to you. And the point that I was going to make about this was that by the time people actually realize that there's a correction underway and they do something about it, then the market has probably already fallen. I mentioned earlier on that the market's already down 5% in September. If you think about that, then the recovery from that already lower position is going to be even quicker. So actually, it becomes more and more risky to get out of the market, because the recovery probably will happen quite quickly. If you're already down 6 or 7%, then there's less and less to gain by getting out of the market. Sorry, that was rather a long answer, Ed, but it's quite an interesting question.
No, that's all right. It is an interesting question. And I think, as I said, it's indicative of lots of the tone of questions that we've had. We always get questions, Tom, don't we? Whenever there's an outlook, we'll get questions about, you know, is it now a good time to take profits or avoid a correction or however you want to term it? People are worried that people have loss aversion. That's a real thing. You know, people don't want to lose money and they're always cautious of that. It does feel that right now that's ratcheted up a bit. And I think maybe the reason is that normally when we have this discussion, it's, well, you can have an optimistic case and a pessimistic case, and the pessimistic case might involve going to certain assets where there's a higher degree of sort of wealth preservation attached to them. It's just hard to find those at the moment. I guess we're going to flesh that out in some of the other answers to some of the other questions today, but there are stocks that are going to hurt when there's inflation, but if inflation bleeds into a sort of wider economic slowdown, that's going to affect a lot more things. It doesn't feel like there's many places to go.
No, I think that's fair. I think, you know, one of the issues is that, you know, there, when we talked about it in the past, you're right to raise this. There's always a sort of offsetting asset class. Normally, bonds and shares sort of move in different directions. I think in an inflationary environment, the challenge is that inflation tends to be bad for everything, really, you know, beyond a certain level. I mean, you could argue that at a relatively low level, then shares are not particularly fazed by inflation. But once it gets beyond a certain level and becomes entrenched, then I think it is quite bad for all asset classes. So that is where the challenge lies, is in finding that safe haven.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get to some of that. But for now, the next question, Tom. Also another popular theme, in particular around China, but this question in particular asks, what is your opinion on China versus India investments? So two massive emerging markets. How do they stack up in your mind, Tom?
Well, very differently at the moment. If you look at the performance of the Chinese market over the last 6 to 8 months, it's been pretty poor. I mean, we think there's lots to worry about in the West, you know, but there's a whole stack of things to worry about in China. In particular, the way in which the government is intervening in various sectors which it perceives to be socially important, education, healthcare, property, and the measures that it's taking are definitely more in favour of the individual, the household, than the business operating in those areas. We've had the Evergrande issue, so that's a worry about the debts which have been run up by that property development company, which of course is related to those areas that the government is focusing on. So, as a consequence of that, overseas investors in China, in particular, are becoming more wary, and we've had created this kind of situation where investors are putting more of a premium on safety when it comes to investing in China. They're more nervous about investing in China, and that's been reflected in valuations. Now, if you look at India, it's almost a complete opposite situation. I mean, the overall situation in India is, on the face of it, not very attractive. It's had a serious problem with COVID, and yet the stock market is soaring. The stock market is standing at an all-time high in India, and it's slightly puzzling. And when I talk to investors in Asia, they are slightly puzzled by it. The Indian market has always been a relatively expensive market, but it seems particularly expensive at the moment. So if you're looking, if you're comparing the two markets and you're looking at sort of risk and return, you know, you have to say that a lot of the bad news seems to be priced into the Chinese market, less so in India.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was looking at, in relation to China in particular, we did have, as I said, like lots of questions about China, and particularly people bemoaning the performance since January or February, and you've seen these big falls. Looking a bit further back, however, the falls came after some really dramatic rises in the Chinese market. And in fact, year on year, broadly speaking, you might be a bit down on your Chinese investments, but versus a year ago, they're not that different. It's just that we've had this big rise and then a big fall in Chinese investments. And that's what it's always sort of been like, isn't it? I mean, I take your points about an apparent change of the weather when it comes to the sort of governance in China, but that's never not been an issue, has it, in China? And you know, I think when we've spoken on the webcast, we answer questions about China, and I made the point that, you know, sometimes China behaves like a giant mainstream market, and it is giant, you know, and sometimes it behaves like an emerging market, and it feels a bit more like an emerging market at the moment.
Yes, it does. And I think, you know, China has always been different. Chinese capitalism is not the same as Western capitalism. And I think it's a mistake for us to think that it would necessarily follow the same pattern, the same model as the West has. It is different. And I think if you're investing in China, you have to accept that. And you're absolutely right to point to the ups and downs. You have to take a long-term view with any of these emerging markets, indeed with any stock market. It's not just emerging markets. You have to accept that they will move up and down. But emerging markets are more volatile, and they do move up and down. You have to take a long-term view when investing in somewhere like China.
Okay. Well, let's move on, Tom. The next one is back on this topic of inflation. I mean, that really was a dominant theme in the questions that we received. The question this time is, with inflation moving from transitory to something more real, why has the gold price been so subdued? Yes, so sort of two parts of that question.
Yes, well, I mean, question there about inflation, is it transitory or is it real? I mean, certainly the evidence seems to suggest that it's more entrenched, it's more real than perhaps the central banks in particular hoped 3 or 4 months ago, when they were, you know, making it clear that they thought that inflation would come and go pretty quickly. So I think that the mood music from the Federal Reserve in particular is a bit more anxious about the prospect of inflation rising. And I think it means that we will see a change in direction of interest rates more quickly than maybe, you know, we had thought. Now, in that environment, you would expect gold to do relatively well. It has traditionally been a decent hedge against inflation. It hasn't performed well. I think there's one sort of major reason for this, and I think that in the past gold was the sort of go-to alternative currency, the go-to hedge against inflation. I think that with the rise of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, there's now an alternative for people to go to. And, you know, a lot of money has gone into cryptocurrencies. And I think that gold has slightly paid the price for that. However, you know, the main driver of the gold price is the real inflation adjusted bond yield. That's the alternative against which the lack of yield of gold is measured. And so if real yields are low, then that ought to be a positive for gold, because there's no opportunity cost in holding gold anymore. Yep. And that hasn't happened. And so I think that, you know, looking forward into a more inflationary environment, I think gold stands out to me as something that people might want to have a bit more of in their portfolios, because it hasn't performed so far. And I think maybe it will do.
Yeah, listen, I've written about this and recorded on the pod as well about my sort of adventures into gold, which I haven't traditionally been that into as an investor. And like a lot of people, I found that it hasn't always followed the script, particularly not this year, as we've seen inflation rise. But I guess there is still that case for it. I mean, on the wider question of inflation, it does seem, Tom, that it just changes the whole calculus. It, when you know that prices are rising in the way that they are and that they're predicted to rise in the future. Thinking back just a year ago, the rate of inflation in the UK, it was barely moving. It was about 0.2%, I think, in September 2020. And it's 3.2% this time round. It's forecast to go higher. That does change the equation, doesn't it, Tom? Because you've got to make that just to stand still. And now we can say, well, you know, inflation's going to erode the value of your money. So if you don't, you know, invest in growth assets, you risk that loss, that sort of inflation erosion effect. But I think psychologically it does change it, doesn't it? People might think, well, I've got to take this risk on investments, and that's just to keep pace with inflation. Maybe it is time to sort of, you know, hunker down.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that, you know, when you are, you know, running up the down escalator, if you like, just to keep yes. still, then it does change your perception of how you should be investing. And maybe it makes you more inclined to sort of look at investments which have an obvious immediate return. So something like a high yielding share, you say, well, look, if nothing happens in the market, at least I'm getting my 3 or 4% from the yield. And then, okay, if I get any capital yeah. growth on top of that, then that's a bonus. But if you're not getting that yield and you're reliant on the capital growth, then maybe you're a bit more anxious that maybe you're not going to get that capital growth. I think you're absolutely right that I think in an inflation environment, we have to change the way that we think. It's been so long since anyone has really had to think about inflation in a serious way.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, let's move on for now, Tom. This next question, it asks, if you hadn't yet invested this year's ISA allowance, would you be doing so into shares, or with the increasingly bleak economic outlook, would you be retaining it as investable cash to then feed in further down the line? So it's a question about how you want to deploy savings in an environment like this.
Yeah. Well, first point I'd make about the cash is, yes, I would hold some cash, and I would probably hold a bit more cash now than I would, traditionally want to do. Not excessively so, because obviously, you know, you're guaranteeing yourself a real inflation adjusted loss at the moment by holding cash. So I wouldn't have a huge amount. But, you know, if we do face a more volatile market, you want some cash. Now, a slightly separate question is this, you know, this how you deploy money into the market. And I think what we tend to say is that doing it on an ongoing basis, not putting all your money in at once, but dripping it into the market over time, does make a lot of sense. And I think it particularly makes sense if you are nervous about the market and you're thinking about volatility ahead, because if you drip your money into the market, then the chances are that you will pick up shares at a lower price than today, and you'll benefit from that. So the answer to that question is, yes, I think I wouldn't put all the money in now in one go if you're sitting on it. I would drip it in over time.
Yeah, and it's always the question, you know, when we address this, we don't know what the best, you know, financial move will be, because that depends on markets. If you put in 20 grand tomorrow and the market goes up, then that would have been the best thing to do. If you yeah. put it in and it goes down, that would have been the worst thing to do. You don't know the effect of phasing in. But as you say, you just get an easier ride by phasing it in, because if markets rise and you've put some but not all of your money in, well, you get something, right? You get a profit on that extra money you've put in. That's not a bad thing. But if it falls, then you can kind of feel confident, well, look, I'm going to put in more and I'm going to buy at a lower level. It makes the whole thing easier to do.
not only does it make it easier to do, it makes it psychologically easier as well. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of that. You know, I mean, if investing is an emotional thing, and whatever you can do to make yourself more relaxed about it, is you're more likely to do it if you're not anxious and nervous about it. And that has to be a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on, Tom. Now, this next one, I don't know if you're going to have answers to this question, but I wanted to ask it because it's a good way into this topic, which I wanted to cover. The question is this: how will the crypto market react in the coming months? Which crypto has the best chance to shine? So tell us, Tom.
Yeah, well, you're right. I can give you a partial answer. I'm not an expert on crypto currencies, but I do follow the market, and I follow people that know a lot more about it than I do. And so what's interesting about it is the first thing about crypto is that the market has come back in recent months, sort of on the sly. You know, it was down at under $30,000. It's now almost, well, it's over $50,000. It's about $55,000, I think, as we speak. Mm. So it has kind of crept up. And one of the measures that people look at is what they call the tourists versus the hodlers. So a hodler is crypto speak for someone who is a convert and is, you know, has got money in Bitcoin and they're never going to sell. They're just holding it forever. The tourists are the people who are, you know, the more speculative investors, and the measurement of a tourist is someone who's basically held their cryptocurrencies for less than 3 months. Now, at the moment, what tends to happen is the market goes up and the number of tourists in the market goes up as well. What we're seeing at the moment is that the market has crept up to almost twice its low point, its recent low point. The percentage of so-called tourists is very low still. So what that suggests is, I think, that there is the potential in the short term for more of these sort of short-term speculative investors to see what's happened and to come back in. So it's a very momentum-driven market. It feels like momentum is positive at the moment and could continue to be for some time. Now, longer term, do you know what? I'm afraid I just haven't got a clue. It's a very complex market. It's not driven by fundamentals in the way that stocks and shares and bonds are. So I'm afraid I don't know.
Well, yes, thanks for your honesty there, Tom. The reason I really wanted to ask this question, or on something on crypto at least, is that we get asked about it more and more, don't we? And it's not just through our work, but also, I mean, in my case, lots of friends and family have asked about crypto. It seems to be very much on people's minds. And I just wanted to pick up on a couple of things. You mentioned there the level of volatility in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, of course, is the most established cryptocurrency. It's doubled this year, I think, after halving in value at the start of the year. You know, it's moved around a hell of a lot, and it's more akin in terms of how it's moved to a small company share, something like that, a single company share. And to be honest with you, if there was an asset that was moving around that much, then just for that reason, really, I think that it shouldn't be more than just a marginal holding for anybody. But just because it is so volatile. A couple of other important things to say. You know, with cryptocurrencies, you've got to consider how you're going to actually invest in this. You're suddenly in the world of crypto exchanges. That's where you buy these things. Then you need to store them. You can store them online in cryptocurrency wallets, or offline in sort of hard drives and things like that. But, you know, I don't know about you, Tom, but that sort of strikes fear into me, having to kind of keep an eye on the security side of it. I mean, I was reading this story about, I presume it's true, but I'll retell it, which is that apparently someone in 2014 was holding 7,000 Bitcoin on an external hard drive, and it was worth, I don't know, $3 million or something at that point. And they lost that hard drive, and that's gone on to be worth something like $300 million now. I mean, I have a meltdown when I forget my password logging on to work in the morning. I don't know how I'd react if I'd lost $300 million on a hard drive because I couldn't access it. That's an extreme example, but you do need to bear in mind exactly how you're going to you're going to store this and hold it. And just finally, I'll say that, you know, there's a tax side to this. You're going to get taxed on cryptocurrency returns under capital gains tax. And that wouldn't happen with assets held inside ISAs and pensions. I don't want to dismiss crypto as a important asset for people. I just think people need to get it into perspective, right? At the moment, it's hard to build your financial security around cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I think all of those points are really well made. And just one further one that I would add is the regulatory aspect to this. We've seen stories in the last couple of weeks about China cracking down on the whole cryptocurrency space. You know, it's unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen. So I think your guidance there about only having a relatively small proportion of your overall investment portfolio in crypto, if you want to, I think is absolutely well made.
Okay. Well, let's move on from that one, Tom. To something on the issue of renewables and ESG, perhaps. The question is this: clean energy funds seem to have risen in price significantly over the past 10 months. Is this market overheated, or should I jump in and invest for the next 5 years? So, what's the answer?
Yes. Well, interestingly, I was having a look at a chart just recently of renewable energy stocks, because they have been very volatile. You talked about crypto being volatile, but renewable energy stocks have been extremely so. And last year, they were very strong. Beginning of this year, they came back very, very sharply. They have definitely stabilized, but they're well below their recent peaks. But they are also well above where they were 2 or 3 years ago. So, you know, I think, you know, I may take issue with the timing referenced in the question, but certainly in general terms, they have gone up a lot in recent years. I think that, you know, this is a long-term story. I mean, clearly, climate change is a huge issue for the world, but it's also a huge investment opportunity. You know, people will make a lot of money out of renewable energy, but as an investor, you have to remember that the price that you pay is just as important as the underlying story. And it's very easy to get swept up in these thematic stories, and there is no bigger theme than climate change. So just be very careful that, you know, that you are being rewarded for the risks that you are taking. And I think that may not necessarily be so in renewable energy at the moment.
Okay. Well, finally, Tom, we have this one last question for you today. And it is this: is the 60-40 investment portfolio still a good idea? So, Tom, is it?
Okay. So let's just explain what this is. So the 60-40, the idea is that you have a balanced portfolio, and the 60 and the 40 refer normally to 60% in shares, 40% in bonds. And traditionally, this kind of balanced portfolio has delivered a very smooth return for investors. And the reason is that bonds and shares have tended to react differently to the same unfolding events. So they have offset each other. So, for example, 18 months ago in the sort of thick of the pandemic bear market, shares fell sharply, bonds went the other way. Actually, investors who had that 60-40 portfolio ended up with a much smoother ride than someone who'd had you know, a bigger exposure to shares, for example. The concern now is that, and we've talked about this already on this pod, that in an inflationary environment, shares and bonds will actually start to move much more together than in opposition to each other. The reason being that inflation, rising interest rates, rising bond yields are bad for bonds, but they're also bad for shares. So what we might find is that shares fall and bonds fall at the same time. So I think that this is a big debate at the moment, because the 60-40 is a very you know, widely used sort of traditional, you know, investment. Financial advisors will often put their clients into a 60-40 portfolio precisely because it has delivered that smooth ride. So it's a big debate at the moment as to whether it will continue to do so. My feeling is, and I've expressed this in the outlook, is that shares feel like the place to be at the moment. I think that in an inflationary environment of rising interest rates, bonds are really going to struggle. And I think that that long bull market that that investors have enjoyed over the years is probably coming to an end.
Yes. And I threw this question in, Tom. I guess it's just another way into that question around which assets in general should you hold. I mean, 60-40 might feel a bit outdated because you want some smaller allocations to other kinds of assets. We've mentioned some of them: infrastructure, gold, commodities of other kinds. There's probably, you know, more than just 60-40. It probably needs to be 60-35-2-1. You know, so it needs to be a wider spread of things. And of course, you know, that should be part of a well-organized set of sort of your wider financial circumstances. So you have things like a pot of cash as well, and that's for your day-to-day living, so that you can ignore some of the movements in markets. Because as we've mentioned, I think, and people will be bored of hearing, it's going to be an unpredictable and choppy period over the next few months and probably the next year or so. And so no one knows exactly what's going to happen. So you just want to cover as many bases as if you realistically can.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that it's going to be more difficult. I think we should not kid ourselves that investing is going to be any easier going forward. And I think the beauty of that 60-40 portfolio, that was so nice and simple, and it delivered you a smooth ride. I think if people are going to achieve that smooth ride in future, they're going to have to work a bit harder. They're going to have to be a bit better diversified. That's not great news, but that is how it is. It doesn't mean that they're not going to get good returns going forward, but I think they're going to have to focus a bit more than they have done in the past.
And just because, Tom, I can't bear to leave things on a negative note. Looking for some silver linings here. I mean, in the outlook, you've mentioned the fact that when you weigh up all these competing variables right now, the one thing that you can say is that there is not a sort of an abundance of exuberance out there, is there? People are quite cautious. And, you know, there's always uncertainty in markets, but you just don't know. And there could be still a leg up in this bull market, and you don't want to miss out on that. You've just got to make sure that you're, as we've said, your finances are organized in a way that you can weather what does come.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, when I get worried in markets is when everyone is super enthusiastic. I can remember very well that period in 1999, 2000, when, you know, everyone was just making money and they just thought nothing could go wrong. That's the time to be nervous. The time not to be nervous is when people are really anxious about things like inflation, about things like interest rates going up. You know, that's when the stock market tends to climb this wall of worry that we always talk about. And that's where I think we are at the moment. So, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. This is not a time to become super pessimistic.
Okay. Well, Tom, we've covered loads. That's all the time we have now for questions. Thanks to Tom for joining us today to answer them. I'll repeat that a full copy of Tom's Investment Outlook is available to download at fidelity.co.uk/outlook. Tom, for now, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.